You're listening to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, recording in Washington, D.C.
And I am your co-host, Katie Putz, also in Washington, D.C.
How's it going today, Katie?
Going well.
It's good to be back. For listeners, we're going to do something that we do periodically on the Asia Geopolitics podcast, which is drawing on Katie's encyclopedic knowledge of all things Central Asia to take stock actually of the Russia-Central Asia relationship, which we've been doing intermittently since the war in Ukraine started. Today, I think we're going to talk about a couple things. I mean, first, we're going to begin by talking about something we didn't talk about back in March when it happened, which was the Crocus City Hall attack in Moscow, which was the worst terrorist attack in Russia in about 20 years, with well in excess of 100 casualties. But more importantly, the Russian security services have alleged that the gunmen involved in the attacks were of Central Asian origin, including some of the co-conspirators. So this has raised, I think, familiar concerns within Russia about the alleged security concerns that arise as a result of certain the sort of well-established people-to-people ties between Russia and Central Asia. So Katie's going to walk us through that a little bit, and then we'll talk a little bit about kind of general Russia-Central Asia relations with some of the developments that have taken place since. But Katie, walk us through a little bit about what our listeners need to know about how the Crocus City Hall attack, I think, factors into the ever-changing Russian attitudes towards Central Asians.
Yeah, so I think it's important to underscore that there are millions of ethnic Central Asians in Russia. Many of them have Central Asian citizenships. Many of them have Russian citizenship. Some have been there for generations. Some are newcomers. And so there has always been sort of a precarity for Central Asians in Russia. They are not Russians. They do not look like Russians. They don't speak, well, they speak Russian, but they speak other languages. They're predominantly Muslim, whereas most Russians are not. And so they have always been a significant minority in Russia. And the Crocus City Hall attack really set off a at least momentary increase in xenophobia, sort of really nasty commentary among the Russian sort of social media and the Russian political sphere. But it's not new. Sort of these kinds of incidents have happened in the past. One notable incident was 2017. There was a bombing in the St. Petersburg metro that was ultimately tied to a Kyrgyz-born Russian citizen. And after each of these incidents, there is sort of this surge in xenophobia. It includes abuse and attacks, but it is all sort of part of a consistent sort of reality of difficulty for Central Asians in Russia.
And so how did the fact that the Islamic State specifically claimed responsibility for this attack kind of affect the dynamics? Because obviously the Islamic State is a global kind of movement, and it's not like Central Asian Muslims in particular have been radicalized at higher rates than sort of others when it comes to the Islamic State specifically. Did that sort of factor in here at all?
Yeah, so one of the interesting things after the Crocus City Hall attack, we did see Islamic State media claiming responsibility for this attack, sharing some videos with the alleged attackers, and that was widely accepted as reality. But at the same time, Vladimir Putin really sort of went out on a kind of a ridiculous limb and tried to pin this on Ukraine.
Of course,
the four alleged gunmen who were all Tajik citizens were detained about 200 miles southwest of Moscow. But when you read reports of where they were detained, it's on the road to Ukraine. It's in the direction of Ukraine, but it's also in the direction of a lot of things. But going back to that, the way that this was kind of discussed is, you know, I think most people do agree and believe that the Islamic State orchestrated this. It fits into a pattern of other similar attacks. I think one of the interesting and somewhat overlooked aspects is about 2 weeks before the Crocus City Hall attack, there were two Kazakh citizens who were, killed in Russia during an anti-terrorist operation that specifically mentioned the Islamic State. It is slipping my mind whether they were just arrested or killed. But that happened like 2 weeks before the Cocoa City Hall attack. And around the same time, the United States and a few European embassies started issuing warnings about the possibility of an Islamic State attack in Russia. And then lo and behold, 2 weeks later, there's an Islamic State attack in Russia. And so the sort of responsibility for this likely rests on the Islamic State sort of architecture. Now, after kind of gets into the weeds, but after the sort of decimation of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, one of the real most active nodes for the Islamic State sort of affiliate network was Khorasan province, which is roughly based in the Afghanistan-Pakistan border areas. And that group has sort of leaned into recruiting Central Asians. The Islamic State did. There was a significant contingent, particularly of Tajiks that ended up in the Middle East. Relative to the, 9 million Tajiks there are, not a lot of people, but relative to other groups, a fairly large contingent. And so that has always been sort of swirling in the ether. Mm-hmm. And so it didn't really come as a surprise. A lot of the Islamic State's propaganda in the last couple of years has included Russia in the list of enemies. So I don't think this was necessarily a surprise. But for Putin, it did present an opportunity for further sort of populist nationalism focusing. It really illustrated kind of the sort of response of the Russian state.
So has the Russian response mostly been kind of confined to kind of domestic security policy and kind of the national debate around immigration from Central Asia? Or have there been sort of observable changes in Russia's foreign policy approach to Central Asia or to Tajikistan specifically in this case?
Yeah, so there hasn't really been observable differences on the sort of elite state-to-state level for Tajiks in Russia. I think listeners will probably be familiar with this at this point, but there's like I said earlier, there's millions of Central Asians in Russia. Every year, there are millions that migrate often seasonally for work in Russia. And so there's always people going back and forth. Central Asian countries, for the most part, I think Turkmenistan might be an example, have visa-free access to Russia. So it should be fairly easy for them to go. But in the last 2 months since the attack, we have seen hundreds, if not thousands, of particularly Tajik citizens who have been denied entry to Russia or deported from Russia. And so there have been some migration difficulties. And it's something that Central Asian leaders have, in limited facets, brought up to Russian policymakers. But it has not really damaged interstate relations, because at the end of the day, for the Central Asian countries from which these people migrate, that need remains. They still need jobs, and Russia is a ready market. And Russia has a serious demographic problem in addition to fighting a war currently, where they need these workers. And so whatever disruption has happened is going to be temporary, and this trade in essentially people is going to continue.
All right, so let's jump ahead a little bit now to, I guess, from March to May, the month that we're currently in. But on May 9th, the leaders of the Central Asian Republics went to Moscow to attend the May 9th commemoration of the end of the Second World War in Russia. Tell us a little bit about the significance of this particular moment and, what this tells us about Central Asia-Russian relations more generally, kind of more than 2 years now into the Ukraine war.
Yeah, so May 9th is celebrated across the former Soviet Union as Victory Day. It marked the end of the war, the Second World War in Europe. Because of the time zones, it's celebrated in the United States on the 8th, and it's celebrated in Russia on the 9th. And in the last decade, two decades, really, it has increasingly become a very nationalistic holiday in Russia. There's almost always some kind of military parade. It's a big moment. And since the war in Ukraine, so the war in Ukraine started in 2022. That year, I believe, only the Tajik president attended the May 9th parade. All the rest of the leaders stayed away. But in 2023, and now again in 2024, all five Central Asian presidents have attended as guests. They have sat in the grandstand with Vladimir Putin and with veterans from the Second World War. They have gone and laid wreaths at monuments in Moscow. And it really is, in the context of the war in Ukraine, and from the Russian perspective, from Putin's perspective, it is a show of support for Russia. Now, I think Central Asian leaders do this very strategically. It's interesting because I tried to go back and look at, you know, who attended when, and in most years, some Central Asian leaders might go, but since the war in Ukraine, other than 2022, they have all five of them have gone, and I think that's sort of a remarkable thing to note. But I don't know that I would. I don't interpret it as sort of complete support for Russia, but it is a moment when they can sort of attend to Putin's need for pomp and circumstance, but also be there and talk to him and have things to say and be needed in a way that I think we often view the Russia-Central Asia relationship as one way. Central Asia needs Russia. In an instance like this, we see the ways in which Russia needs Central Asia, because otherwise it would be Vladimir Putin standing there alone. I think there was one other Asian leader who came, and then like the president or prime minister of Guinea-Bissau. So Russia's friend list is very small, and it's mostly Central Asians at this point. And so them showing up really communicates something, gives them an opportunity for that FaceTime and that conversations they can have with Putin.
Do we know anything about what those conversations were this particular time, and what are the leaders of the Central Asian republics asking of Putin in this particular moment?
Yeah, so this is maybe, unfortunately, we don't get a lot of information about what is actually discussed. One of the things that I noted, so the day before the parade, they conveniently scheduled a Eurasian Economic Union meeting. So the presidents of the countries that are in the Eurasian Economic Union, which in this context includes Russia, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan of Central Asia. There's also Armenia, Belarus. And at that meeting, the Kyrgyz president brought up the issue of labor mobility, which was a very diplomatic way of asking. It was interesting because Armenia is the current chair of the Eurasian Economic Union. And so everything was addressed to the chair. But really, this was a question for Vladimir Putin about Russia. Because when you're talking about the Eurasian Economic Union, you're talking about labor mobility, it's everyone trying to get into Russia for jobs, because there are a lot more jobs in Russia than in the rest of the Eurasian Economic Union. And he did bring this up. What the answer was, we don't get to know that. But it is interesting, and I thought it was worth noting that these issues did get brought up, and that was probably one of the reasons that the Kyrgyz president showed up to this. There are other reasons, but it certainly is a solid one to sort of be in those kinds of meetings and have an opportunity to raise those issues, at the same time demonstrating, like, you want me in this room, here are some of the things I'm concerned about. And so that's definitely a big one.
All right. Well, Katie, I think we'll leave it there for today. As always, thanks so much for sharing all of your insight about Central Asia in particular, because, I think it's been useful to kind of intermittently revisit this issue, and I guess we'll continue to do that. But thanks for joining me.
Yeah, always a pleasure.
Great. And for listeners, make sure you subscribe so you can keep up with future episodes of the podcast. And if you've been a subscriber for a while, make sure you leave us a review. You can do that anywhere you get your podcast. We really do appreciate that. And as always, if you have suggestions for content that you'd like to see covered on the podcast, feel free to reach out to either myself or Katie. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll be back soon with more.